a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom. For the land commits great whoredom by the forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, Call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. She conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, Call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all, but I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, Call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, You are not my people, it shall be said to them, Children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, You are my people, and to your sisters, You have received mercy.
Thank you. Please hold that open, page 908. And as we, just before we begin looking at it, let me ask you a question. How do other people see you? I wonder if you know. Most of us are not very good at answering that kind of question. So what kind of colleague are you? What kind of husband or boyfriend are you? What kind of student are you? What kind of student housemate are you? Are you able to see yourself from other people's point of view? Not many people can do that. Can you feel how a wife might feel about the way you peel off bits of your toenails and then eat them? Can you imagine why that might not be a good thing? Can you see it from her side? I particularly love the stories of angry neighbours. Basically every day in the papers, story of an angry neighbour. The sort of, I have no idea why they're upset about my hedge, even though it's bigger than their house. That one, there's a guy called David in Plymouth who the photo is of kind of house, garden, house, tree! Like this. And he has no idea why they might be upset. His tree is 10 metres tall. If we got in your colleagues and your other half and your housemates and we asked them up here and we got them to speak about you, how do they see you? And do you know? Are you the kind of lovable rogue or are you a pain in the neck? And I think we're particularly bad at seeing ourselves from God's point of view. So you ask most people in this country, what kind of person are you? Or how do you think God sees you, which is the same question. And most people talk about what a decent bloke they are. Or, you know, I do some bad things, but I do lots of good things as well. I'm okay. The book of Hosea is asking God to come in here. It's giving him the microphone and asking what kind of people we are from his point of view. And 2,750 years ago, he picked a prophet called Hosea and said, right, Hosea, I'm going to get you to choose a wife that reminds me of my people Israel. And I think most of us would say, well, lucky Hosea. Great, God's going to get him a wife that reminds him of his people Israel. Maybe a pop star or an actress, would that be about right? For God's chosen people, somebody special, certainly. I don't know, was the time for Hosea to discuss this with his mates? So Jonathan the farmer says, well, I think she'll be the sort of pure and beautiful type. Long hair, wonderful smile. That's what it's like for God to wake up with Israel. No, says Shebna, the shepherd. She'll be much more interesting than that. She'll be dazzling and quirky. She'll make people stop and look. She'll make you laugh all the time. God wakes up in the morning, looks at us, and it cheers him right up. And look what God says in verse 2. Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom, and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. Do you get the point? Three times, shockingly? It's a shock, isn't it? It's our big idea in 7 weeks in Hosea. There in our first point on the handout, if you want to use that. Point one, being God of Israel is like being married to a whore. I guess that is not what Hosea was expecting. It's very shocking. That may not be what you expected the Bible to say in church this evening. It is so shocking that Bible commentators down the years have just not been able to believe that's what it really says. God couldn't have wanted a prophet to really and truly go and marry a prostitute. Surely. But the command is entirely matter of fact. And what happens in verse 3 is just told entirely like history. If it makes you feel any better, she may not actually be working as a prostitute yet. She may just be her community's most famous, most promiscuous person. But is that much better? The prostitution's certainly there by chapter 2 and chapter 3. And Hosea can't say then that he wasn't warned. It's really, really shocking, isn't it? And all the reasons why a prophet couldn't, shouldn't marry a prostitute are exactly the point. He's not going to enjoy this marriage. And God doesn't enjoy being married to us all that much either, is the point if you're in Old Testament Israel. So I think this really is Hosea telling us about his real and only wedding day and his real children. God asked Hosea to live out what it feels like for him to be God. Being God of Israel is like being married to a whore. So here's something that probably happened 2,750 years ago. Hosea's dad, whose name is Beeri, which is a good name in verse 1, much against his better judgment, he goes off to see a man called Diblaim, verse 3, and says, I'd like to arrange a wedding. And Diblaim falls off his bench laughing. Your son wants to marry my Gomer? Crazy fool. If she's taken his fancy, all he's got to do is be human after happy hour on Friday. But Beeri goes red. It says, no, really. This is what we want. We want a wedding. And Diblaim thinks he understands. Have they already? Is she pregnant again? Is she blackmailing your son? Look, it's happened so often. We've got a system for this. Me and my wife, we bring up the children. The father just pays a lump sum up front, and then we never bother him again. Just join the queue and pay the money. It'll all be okay. No, Mr. Diblaim, nothing like that. My Hosea is a good boy, but God has told him to marry Gomer. The car, the service, the cake, the honeymoon, the promises to be together forever. But Mr. Beeri, she's my daughter. I guess I love her more than anyone, and I've no idea where we went wrong, but she is just not capable of keeping those promises. She cannot make your son happy. Go take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, which probably means he's got to adopt the current brood she already has by half the men in the town. Though I guess it also means get ready, because every time she has a baby, you're going to be playing guess who the father is. Surveys apparently say that Britain is the most promiscuous Western nation, but even in London this story has power to shock, doesn't it? Even in London, the idea of kind of going to deliberately begin a relationship like this. But just imagine what it meant in their culture, where a girl who wasn't a virgin was thought to be unmarriageable. What it meant to go and marry Gomer. The towns of northern Israel, they're not big places, not big enough so that Gomer can invite people to the wedding who don't know exactly who his new bride is. You know, she's from out of town. You may not know her. I don't think you do know her from work. He marries a whore so that he can tell people how God feels when he wakes up with Israel. That's the big idea in our book. We're just going to sort of introduce it today. And what is surprising initially is that it looks like God has to really labour this point. Obviously this point is worth making strongly if it's worth Gomer having this kind of marriage for. Well, let me help you imagine how they felt about God, why they didn't spot that their idolatry and their chasing after other gods, their forsaking the Lord, they didn't realise that felt like great whoredom to God. So you need to know that Hosea lives in northern Israel, and that life in northern Israel is good. Write down 2 Kings 14 if you want to check this later. Verse 1 here gives us two huge big name kings. There's Uzziah, or Amaziah in 2 Kings of Judah, and Jeroboam the second of Israel. And it is nearly 200 years since Solomon died and the empire was split, and it was split into two bits. And there is no doubt which half you would rather live in. Uzziah rules over 1.5 tribes. Jeroboam the second rules over 10. And just in case we're not good enough at maths to work out who makes the stronger one, their daddies had a war. We have the War of the Roses in England. They had the War of the Weedy Thistle. That's how the Israelites reacted when Judah challenged them to a fight. They said, look, we're like a tree, and you are like a weedy thistle. And if we have a war, we're going to stamp on you. And they did have a war, and they did stamp on them. Israel defeated them. Judah ran away. And Jeroboam's dad went to Jerusalem. He put a 180-meter hole in the walls. He took out all the gold and silver in the treasury in the temple, and he took home a load of hostages who grow up bowing and scraping to little boy Jeroboam. But as that wasn't enough, Jeroboam himself is no slouch as well. In medieval England, if you want to be a good king, you only need to do one thing, don't you? You have to beat the French, and that's what it's all about. If you can beat the French, ideally capture Paris, then basically you're made. You're a good king, that's what it's all about. Well, in 8th century Israel, you had to beat the Syrians. They're a big country with a big army, and their capital is Damascus. Sad, isn't it, that actually probably a year ago I might have had to tell you that, but actually recently we've been watching that on the news for more death and more anger recently. But in their day, ancient Israel, they'd have been much more worried about Damascus actually than we are. Ever since Solomon, they had been eating away at the northern border of Israel, slowly making it Syrian. But Jeroboam, he pushes that border all the way back through Damascus and beyond. You look at the maps, and he doubled his kingdom, which is pretty good. We're a nation that is going places. The money is flowing in. We know all about their silver and their gold, their oil and their wine, and their beds made of ivory. Anyone have a bed made of ivory? It's probably illegal, but that's what they had. And all of that makes them think God must be fine with them. Things are going well, we're indestructible, God must be happy. But they have no sense at all of what they look like from God's point of view. It's a lot like the flatmates, who has no idea everyone else knows how little they wash up. God even says, chapter 7, verse 2, they do not consider that I remember all their evil. They just have no idea. Externally, everything looks okay, so I must be getting away with it in the relationship. If her car is still in the garage, then our marriage must be fine. She must be happy. Be easy to think that, wouldn't it? And not consider that your spouse might remember, might see what you're really like. And what God says Israel is really like is unfaithful, like a whore. So verse 2, forsaking the Lord, means idolatry, and Israel had gone for that spectacularly. The God's temple was in Jerusalem, which is where Judah was. So they thought, well, we'll just have our own religion. And they made some golden calves. They were the official religion. But then on every hilltop and under every tree, you had your own little local gods. And there were Baals, and there were Asherahs, and there were pillars, and there were all sorts. And they worship all sorts. And God says, that makes you a whore. That makes you unfaithful. What do you think? Is that strong language for God to use? Is it the kind of language God should be allowed to use? Or is it just God being accurate? What it feels like to be followed by people who keep running off and worshipping other gods. Do you see it from God's point of view? And we'll keep coming back in this series to see if we as 21st century people recognise their problem in ourselves. See, not many of us worship golden statues, I guess, though a few here may have family from certain parts of the world who do, or may have family from other parts of the world who worship their ancestors. But the Bible says all of us are prone to this. Whether we have a kind of physical statue or not, we're all prone to idolatry. Which is to say, all of us forsake the Lord to worship something else. And we take something out of all the stuff that God created and we make it a god. So for instance, one of the horrible things about all the redundancies going on at the moment is that for a lot of people, their job is not just their job. And it'd be terrible to lose your job, wouldn't it? I guess there's people here who've had that maybe several times. Terrible to lose your job and your income, to not know what's going to happen next. But much worse if you lose your job and discover that your job was your life or your God, as quite a few people have discovered. If you only felt good about yourself because you had that kind of job. If you had such high expectations of your job, you thought your job would make you happy and keep you safe forever. A horrible thing when your God lets you down, which is what a lot of people have discovered recently. Here's a set of questions I've collected over the years. You might want to write a couple of these down. If you want to work out what it is that you are tempted to worship instead of God. So the sort of things people in our culture often talk about are our money, or pleasure, or success, or family, or brilliance, those kind of things being their gods. And you notice all of them are good things. Every single one of the things on that list are good things in themselves, made by gods. But good things, if you make them into God things, in other words, if you worship them, then you've made them an idol. So here are some questions maybe to ask. What is it that I could not live without? What is it I couldn't live without? So if I could be unhappy and lonely and hated as long as I'm rich, if I could cope with being unhappy and lonely and hated as long as I'm rich, then chances are money is my God. Or other way around, if I could be poor and a failure as long as everybody likes me, then chances are popularity is my God. And what happens when you get the choices? Second question, when you get the choices between staying popular maybe or following God. And that's when you discover which one you worship. Your God always wins. And if your God is being popular, then your God will win. Or another question, what is it that reassures me? When life is really bad, where do I turn? Where do I say it's everything's still okay because? Everything's still okay because I got those A-levels. Everything's still okay because I'm with her. Or another question, what do you think will keep you safe? Or what do you think gives your life its meaning? Or what is it that you get really angry about when it's threatened? When somebody threatens it, you get really, really angry. What is it that occupies the ultimate space in the universe for you? What's in the God space? See, following those things, living for those things, is forsaking your true God. Is a kind of unfaithfulness, or promiscuity, or hoarding. And the illustration is a really powerful one, isn't it? Though I guess it cost Gomer a great deal, and Hosea to live it out. How did Hosea feel when Gomer slipped out at night to go and visit a boyfriend? What did he feel when he came home early and heard the other men letting themselves out of the back door? How did it feel when he realised she wasn't just sleeping with other people, but she was being paid for it? Actually, we'll see as we go on in future weeks, the parallel is closer than we care to admit. I worship success or popularity or achievement because I expect to get paid. I expect to be rewarded by those things if I chase after them. That is saying something about how I feel about the God I'm in relationship with. And you look at Mr. and Mrs. Hosea and Gomer if you want to know God's point of view. Being God of Israel is like being married to a whore. And that is not something that can go on forever. God is not like the, did you have prefects at your school or whatever you called them? God is not like that in kind of, yeah, he can put up with everything and then nothing's too serious. This is like being stuck in a marriage and that is as messed up as Hosea and Gomer's. And so God tells Hosea to call the children the kind of thing you'd normally put in the divorce papers. So point two, this is a relationship with no future. There are three children, they get three names, none of the names is happy. This is a completely miserable family setup. So son number one, he is, by the way, the only one we're told for certain is Hosea's. Verse 3 bore him a son. And he gets called Jezreel, which you'd think is a nice name. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Jezreel. If you didn't know any of Israel's recent history. And this is like calling a kid Srebrenica after the massacre in 1995. Jezreel is where there was a terrible massacre. Actually, closer still, it's a political point. It's like somebody in the Russian church calling their child after the place where they killed the Tsar and his family. You met my little boy? Yekaterinburg? It's kind of snappy. Jezreel is where the king's great-grandfather Jehu had killed the entire previous royal family. Call his name, verse 4, Jezreel. For in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. Now, if we didn't have verse 2, we'd be puzzled by that, I think, because God, if you know the story well, God had commanded Jehu to do that, commanded him to overthrow the previous king, and Jehu had been an improvement in a lot of ways. He'd taken out the Baal worship that Ahab had led everyone into, and he'd led it into a better direction. So now why would God punish them for something that he'd commanded? I think there's two parts to that answer. One, we're given, I think, in verse 2, the other one I think we've got to assume is that. So part of the answer may be something in the way that Jehu did it or his motive. So God told him to do it, but Isaiah 10 gives us a similar example where the Assyrian king attacks at God's command but goes way beyond his role as God's agent through to loving his destruction and proudly saying he's doing it because he's stronger than God. So God judges Assyria for that. Maybe Jehu's done the same thing. But more than that, from verse 2, he did stop Baal worship at the time, but he kept all the golden calves going, and by his great-grandson's day, Baal is back. So you call your first boy Jezreel because there's going to be a massacre, another massacre. First, it's going to be of the house of Jehu, but also, verse 4, I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And the place where that's going to happen will, ironically, be the Valley of Jezreel. And I think this is part of how prophecy works, that God predicts some events so that when they come true, you can have more confidence in the things he says are going to happen next. And I think for us that happens in three stages here. You see, when Hosea first said it at the baby naming party, it must have sounded absurd. Jeroboam II is the strongest king in years. The house of Jehu is cemented in power, and since his conquest of Syria, Jezreel is miles and miles and miles and miles away from the nearest hostile army. But when Jeroboam died, do you know how long his son lasts? 6 months. 6 months before someone called Shalom killed him, and that was the end of Jehu's house. First part of verse 4 comes true. And after Jeroboam, there are only six more kings of Israel in total. They don't take long. It takes about 30 years. Only one of them died of old age and passed the kingdom to his son. And do you know what? They all scrabbled out their rule in the shadow of a great imperial power that comes at them from the north. Syria was beaten not because Jeroboam was very good at fighting, but because some really big bully boys called the Assyrians had just kicked the stuffing out of them from the other side. And it wasn't long before Assyria came back and in and through Jezreel to besiege the last king of Israel in Samaria and destroy the whole lot. The date 722 is on your handout. And we know that Hosea lived to see it because he tells you which kings he lived through in Judah, and he does at least 6 years afterwards. How do you think he felt naming a child he knew would see the whole nation destroyed? Did Jezreel make it? We're not told. But God leaves us in no doubt why this is going to happen. It's because of their forsaking him, and because verse 6 and verse 8, he's decided to divorce them. The daughter is called No Mercy, and the next son is called Not My People. And again, there's hints here they'd have struggled to take this seriously. What do you mean God's going to stop showing mercy to us? Do you not realise there are these promises going on for thousands and thousands of years? And do you not realise, and verse 6 surely is ridiculous, and 7, the idea that Israel would be destroyed and Judah left standing, weedy, thistly Judah, and Israel destroyed. But verse 7 tells us exactly what happened. God did have mercy on Judah and not on Israel. They are smaller, but they were saved by the Lord their God, not by bows or swords or horses. And the Assyrians sweep through Israel, hardly noticing them. And then they come in to conquer Jerusalem, and they camp outside Jerusalem, and one night, thousands and thousands of them die. There's no battle, and the Assyrians go home. Exactly what God says is going to happen, happens. And it's all there in the namings of the kids, in Hosea's marriage. So Hosea's marriage is a grim one, but his children's name means something worse. End of verse 9 is the low point, really. Call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. And there's the divorce word in God terms. I'm not going to be your God anymore. And I wonder what you think, whether God would ever say that, whether God could ever say it. Like I say, I meet lots of people who just think God wouldn't do that. I'm a decent person. God must be happy with me. God shouldn't be so small-minded that he should mind if people worship other things. He should be bigger than that. I think it's because we have all sorts of wrong illustrations about God in our heads. Again, that God is like the kind of teacher at school, or God is kind of weighing a scales to see who's good and bad and giving out presents. Even, I think, because we go very big on the Bible image of the father and the child, which is there in the Bible, it's there in Hosea, we'll get to it later on in the series. But if that is your controlling image for you and God, then that totally changes what happens when you do something wrong, doesn't it? You do something wrong, and it's God's job to kind of not be too upset, and that, well, you've just kicked a chair over or thrown a drink on the floor, come on, we'll put you back on your feet, we'll teach you, because you need to learn, but it's all for your good. And we run that image, partly that's just a complete misunderstanding of father and son in Middle Eastern culture at the time, but partly it misses out this huge slab of what it's like for God to be in relationship with us. It's like he's married to us. Which means we're not just kind of kicking chairs over and spilling drinks. It means we're being unfaithful. And I guess most of us, in our own relationships, think that's a pretty bad thing. Think that's something to kind of aim at not doing, something to be offended about if someone else does it to us. Just try running the kind of things we say with God in a relationship. Valentine's Day coming up soon, so here you go, here's how it might go. I think you'll be really pleased with me this week, dear, because all week I have been much more faithful than Bill. Does that work? And yet, you know, we run that with God, don't we? All week I've been much better than those other people. Or how about I've been at least 50% faithful this week. I think my faithfulness has basically outweighed my unfaithfulness. I've slept around a lot less than I haven't slept around. Does that work? And here are some flowers. And yet, that is how we try to run our relationship with God and assume that he won't mind. So if you can imagine Hosea weeping into his pillow and shouting at why is this happening, then maybe you begin to imagine what it feels like for God to be married to Israel. But just last thing to say, because this is how the book's going to treat us again and again and again, is there is a sudden flip. In verse 10 you get the word yet, which is, even that's kind of slightly improved the original, so it sounds like there's a bit of a change of tack there. Because again and again and again in this book, I think maybe it's part of the kind of conflicted emotion of how God feels in a marriage with somebody he loves but who keeps playing away. There's this kind of flip to the complete opposite. Point 3, yet still there will be mercy. And it's a total reversal. 1 verse 9 was the end of Abraham's covenant. But if you know the Bible at all, you'll recognise verse 10. We're back with Abraham, and there will be so many children, it'll be like the sand of the sea, so you can't number them. And what we're going to do is we're going to go and stand in Jezreel. I think that's the place in verse 10. And we're going to say the opposite of those three children's names. In other words, we're going to undo the divorce. So we're going to say, you are my people. You are the children of the living God. And what we're going to do even more than that, verse 11, we're going to undo 200 years of split and put Judah and Israel back together. They'll have one king and they shall be properly rooted back in the promised land. And we'll call that the great day of Jezreel, because everything will have flipped on its head. And 2 verse 1, as well as the kid Jezreel having their name reversed, we're going to call the brothers my people, and we're going to call the sisters mercy. You have received mercy. It's astonishing, isn't it? After everything we've just said, after everything in terms of how God must feel about these people, to say there'll be a day when the divorce will be over. It's like you've been at the counselling session with Hosea and Gomer, and you've been it's been the first session and it's not gone very well, and you've asked questions like, when did the unfaithfulness begin? And Hosea said, well, it was on the wedding night, I think, and this sort of stuff. And then, just as they're kind of trudging off, Hosea turns around at the door and says, well, look, would you come to our moving back in together party? We're going to have this great party, and we're going to have a redoing of our marriage vows, and it's going to be fantastic. All the children are going to be, will you come? And you think, how on earth are you saying, even as she's out there flirting with the security guards, Hosea is talking about getting the marriage back together. Really? Is that really going to happen? Do you feel the shock of this relationship getting back together again? This isn't just wiping the nose of a snotty child and saying, I'm big enough, we can be friends again. And this would be God having back the prostitutes. Just imagine what would need to change. Imagine what it would take in both parties, in him and her, before that could be a happy marriage again. What would need to be mended? And yet that is the Christian hope. That is the Christian gospel. Do you think God should do that? Do you think that's a good idea of God? Do you think that's a clever move from God? Would you, if you were the marriage guidance counsellor, would you be suggesting it? And yet, two places in the New Testament pick up on 2 verse 1. Romans 9 and 1 Peter 2. Both times to say, here's a way of thinking about what it is to be loved by God in the gospel. The people who were not my people, the people I'd cast off and divorced, those people I'm going to have back and make my people. Do you feel the shock that there's a positive after all we've said? Like maybe you shouldn't really believe the gospel. Shouldn't really be true. Certainly we shouldn't take the gospel for granted. I want to suggest something. It's quite a cheesy story. I was told this when I was 10. I have no idea if it's true or not. The story is of some wandering missionary in some distant, backward part of colonial Britain. So it was probably in Canada or in Australia or Scotland or somewhere like that. And the story is he's wandering by this kind of little chapel, and he meets, and I can't remember if it was some sort of sweet little person. And the person says, look, teach me to pray. What should I pray? And the missionary says 5 words. Pray, dear Lord, show me myself. And the missionary heads off over the mountains and away. And says, do that every day. Show me myself. Dear Lord, show me myself. Comes back a few weeks later. Sweet little person is a total wreck in the corner. Total wreck. I've been doing that every day since you said, dear Lord, show me myself. And I hate what I see. I keep letting God down. I never realised it before. I can't do what I want to do for a second. God must hate me. I've stopped praying, to be honest. And she said, oh, well, why don't you pray something else instead? Pray, dear Lord, show me thyself, yourself. Pray that every day. Until you realise that, yes, God knows exactly what you're like. But if you really see what God is like, if you can really see what God is like, he is the person astonishingly who has back the prostitute. So should we get married again? That'd be a good idea. I want to make that sort of person his people again. That's where we're going to go through the rest of the book. Let me pray. Dear Lord and Father, we so easily assume that you see us the way we see ourselves, that you're fooled by us. Lord, please, please, would this book of Hosea show us ourselves, show us what we're really like. And Lord, as we do that, please, please help us realise what we do to you. But also, Father, please, please, would it make us so amazed and love you so much that you have us back in the gospel, that that's the kind of person you are, the kind of husband you are. Father, praise you for the gospel. Amen.